the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Now let's read the Bible together, shall we? We're going to read from Genesis chapter 11. We're going to read some verses which kick off a series for us, which we're going to be pursuing over the next few weeks, about eight dimensions of what it means to live by faith. And we're going through the story of Abraham. In fact, this year we're going to look at all of the patriarchs, the people who were the foundations of basically what we are this morning. The people with whom God started to work, to start to bring the world back to himself, the project that culminated in the coming of Jesus. And so Abraham's right at the start of that, and it's his story. So let's read from Genesis chapter 11 and verse 10. This is the account of Shem's family line. 2 years after the flood, when Shem was 100 years old, he became the father of Arphaxad. And after he became the father of Arphaxad, Shem lived 500 years and had other sons and daughters. When Arphaxad had lived 35 years, he became the father of Shelah. And after he became the father of Shelah, Arphaxad lived 403 years and had other sons and daughters. When Shelah had lived 30 years, he became the father of Eber. And after he became the father of Eber, Shelah lived 403 years and had other sons and daughters. When Eber had lived 34 years, he became the father of Peleg. And after he became the father of Peleg, Eber lived 430. I'm sure you're seeing the pattern here. And so for 10 generations, all that seems to happen, all you can say about these people is they lived, they had a successor, they had other children, and they died. And then things change in verse 26. After Terah had lived 70 years, he became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. This is the account of Terah's family line. Terah became the father of Abraham, Nahor, and Haran became the father of Lot. While his father Terah was still alive, Haran died in Ur of the Chaldeans in the land of his birth. Abraham and Nahor both married. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah. She was the daughter of Haran, the father of both Milcah and Iscah. Now Sarai was childless because she was not able to conceive. Terah took his son Abram, his grandson Lot, son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, the son of his wife Abram, and together they set out from Ur of the Chaldeans to go to Canaan. But when they came to Charan, they settled there. Terah lived 205 years, and he died in Haran. The Lord had said to Abram, "Go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." So Abram went, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he set out from Haran. He took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, all the possessions they had accumulated, and the people they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan, and they arrived there. Abram travelled through the land as far as the site of the great tree of Moriah at Shechem. At that time the Canaanites were in the land. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. From there he went on towards the hills east of Bethel and pitched his tent, with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. There he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. Then Abram set out and continued towards the Negev. Well, that's a passage for this morning, and you don't need me to tell you that yesterday was quite an exciting day in terms of the National Lottery. The biggest ever prize that there has been, and loads of people got very excited about it. All the papers were talking about it. Lotto players advised to buy tickets for record jackpot early. How often does the Guardian talk about the lottery? But it was doing it yesterday. And the other papers were giving lists of numbers, which are the best numbers to pick and the worst numbers to pick. So apparently if you want to win the lottery, never start with the number one. And other papers were talking about the way in which the whole thing was ramped up as the end approached, and 400 tickets a second were being sold as the close of play came up. Mind you, if you bought a ticket yesterday, you were probably quite stupid, because your chances of winning were not exactly great. In fact, you're twice as likely to be made a saint by the Pope as you are to win the National Lottery. And if you think about Tim Peake up in space, you're four times as likely to become an astronaut as you are to win the National Lottery. And the Scottish Daily Record worked out the most interesting and bizarre one. It's less likely that you'll win the lottery than that Prince William will have 11 children, all of whom turn out to win Olympic gold medals. So, don't buy lottery tickets, and if you feel you've got money to burn that you don't need any longer, I'll give you the details of my bank account later. It's taking a pretty wild chance, isn't it, doing something like that? I suppose the story we're talking about this morning seems like a pretty wild chance to some people as well. Here you have this man, Abram, who's living in a very sophisticated city, as we'll see in a moment, who suddenly, all of his life, he's been worshipping, we imagine, the moon god, suddenly finds a new voice speaking to him. Now, how that voice started speaking to him, we're not dead sure. Did he have a vision? Was it a series of dreams? Was it a voice in his head? Did some angels appear to him? We don't know. But what we do know is that somehow a bigger God, a greater God than any he'd come into contact before, suddenly cut through and said, "Hey, Abram, I'm here. I'm real. And what's more, I have plans for your life. And I challenge you to leave everything you've known and go to a place you've never been before, a far less comfortable, far less civilized place. And there, I will not only fill your life with blessing, but also make you such a blessing that every family on earth will be blessed because of you." That's a pretty big promise. And you could sympathize with Abram thinking, "No way, no, I'm just going crazy, I need to see a therapist," and sitting still exactly where he was. But he took the chance. And he found by taking it, his chances weren't 1 in 45 million. His chances were 1 in 1. Because the God who was speaking to him was entirely and totally dependable. And so I think Abram has an awful lot to teach us about where we have to go with God if we want to know him in the same way this morning. Let's talk about Abram for a minute. Where did he come from? That's Ur of the Chaldees, down towards the bottom corner of the map there, just in from the Arabian Gulf. In fact, in Abram's day, it was on the coast. So it was a trading centre. It was a place that lots of trade passed through, a seaport, all kinds of different things. It's inland nowadays because the sea was silted up, and that led to the decline of Ur. But in those days, it was a pretty big place. It was part of Mesopotamia, which is that area there, between the Euphrates and the Tigris and some lands around it. Massive place, which was really the cradle of world civilization in lots of ways. You tend to think of Abram, if you've heard the stories first in Sunday school, as some kind of guy with a tea towel tied round his head to and a bathrobe on who went into the desert and herded a few sheep. He wasn't like that. He was a pretty smart cookie. And he came from a very sophisticated place indeed, as we will see. What God was challenging him to do was to go over there, to the land of Canaan, where he had never been before. And God said, "That is my plan, not just for you, but for the whole world." So the journey is just to look at where we're going over the next few weeks. The first thing that Abram did, as we read, was to go up to Haran in the north, or Haran. And he took his whole family with him. In fact, his father was still alive at this point, so his father probably directed the pace of the operation. We don't really know. But anyway, when they got to Haran, they stuck there for reasons which aren't explained. And they stayed there for a while until Terah, Abram's father, died. And then he was free to pursue his dream, to follow the vision. And God spoke to him again, and he went down the road into Canaan. And we saw him in the passage going to Shechem, which was a shrine, as we'll discover in a minute, and looking for that God, looking for the fulfillment of that promise in the country where he was supposed to be. Well, through the story, as we'll see, he goes into Egypt and comes back, but spends most of his time in that promised land, gradually learning more about God and the promises, which are going to be far bigger than Abraham's own life. He was blessed massively as an individual, but the great blessing was still to come. Because what God was doing was taking Abram and using him as the start of a process that one day would lead right through his line to the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ. You see, after the fall, the time when human beings rebelled against God and said, "We're not having you, we don't want you on our planet, we want to run our lives ourselves," God had a problem. What was he to do? Wipe the earth out and start again? He didn't want to do that. He loved people. Pretend that sin didn't matter, and if they'd rebelled against him, that was just kids, and kids will be kids. He couldn't do that either. Because if God is the moral arbiter of the universe, he can't just treat disobedience and rebellion as if it doesn't count for anything. So what does God do? Well, to bring the world back to himself, God started with a man. A man who was specially spiritually sensitive, someone who would listen, someone who'd take a massive, massive chance and gamble with his life on a promise that God made to him. And that was Abraham. And as you can see on the chart, the man became a family. The family became a tribe. The tribe became a nation. And down through the years, those lessons that Abraham had learned on his journey with God became focused and sharper and clearer as time went by. Until eventually, a nation was prepared. A nation that was sinful and got it wrong again and again, went into exile and came back and all sorts of other colourful adventures. But a nation that was prepared all the same, where God's own son could enter the human race. And people could understand what this was all about because God had explained himself clearly enough through prophets and teachers down through the centuries up until then. So Abraham was at the start of a very, very important process indeed. I think there are three challenges he gives us. First is, dare to be different, to stand out from the world around you. Christians are supposed to be different people. People who follow God are marching to the beat of a different drummer. There are people who don't live in step with what everybody expects from you in society. They're different in all kinds of ways. And the reason that they're different is because they're daring to be dependent. They don't live life by their own decisions, by their own wits, by what seems right to them. They get themselves into situations where if God does not exist, they are absolutely stuffed. Because everything depends on the goodness and the faithfulness of a God who puts them in ridiculous situations. And the third challenge is dare to be determined. Because you can start out that way. You can be keen and daring and risky when you're young and then get middle-aged and comfortable. And Abram just kept on going. So those are the three things we want to examine this morning. Let's look at the first of them. Dare to be different. Abram came from a city which was quite interesting. His life was already sophisticated. His life was already spiritual. And his life was already settled. But he went out for more. Sophisticated. Well, Ur was a pretty sophisticated place. In fact, it's been calculated by statisticians that at this stage in the history of the world, Ur of the Chaldees, that's the city that you see in front of you there, was the biggest city on earth. It had a whopping 60,000 people living there, half the size of Exeter, but it was massive in those days. And so Ur was a centre of civilization in a way that very few other places were. And the Sumerians, the Mesopotamians could do things that other civilizations took centuries more to discover. For one thing, they had writing, and that's one reason we know so much about them. They wrote all sorts of things down. They also were good at architecture. The Romans thought they'd invented the arch many centuries later. They hadn't. The arch was in use in Ur of the Chaldees by Mesopotamian architects. There was a postal service, Steve Davis would be glad to hear. Cities of Sumeria were linked by a very effective postal system. You could send a clay tablet from one place to another with no problem whatsoever. Mathematics was part of the deal as well. There were better mathematicians, Johnny Baker will be glad to hear, than many other nations were for many centuries to come. They invented the four-wheeled chariot. And that meant they had to invent the wheel first. So they were probably the people who thought of the idea of the wheel. That's not bad. That's a pretty good invention. And obviously, if you've got four-wheel chariots, you need good roads for them to trundle along. And they had good roads as well. They were good at ceramics. They were good at sculpture. They were good at smelting copper. They did just about everything. They even invented machinery. And they had some pretty sophisticated stuff. For example, centuries before anybody else got round to it, they invented a machine for scattering the seed on the field as it was ploughed up by the cows. You just drop it down that little hopper there, and that means you don't have to go around with a basket sowing it by hand. Labour-saving devices. Having invented the wheel, they invented the potter's wheel, and that's why their pottery was so good as well. So Abram was living in a luxurious place, a place that was top of everything. And God was saying to him, give it up. Leave your comforts. Go to this wild place which I'm going to give to you and do something completely different. And you know, down through Christian history, that's often been the way. People who have had all of the world's blessings laid before them have suddenly uncomfortably heard the voice of God saying, give it up. Go and do something different. Think of Lord Shaftesbury, the great 19th century reformer. Think of C.T. Studd, who could have been Prime Minister of Great Britain without any problem whatsoever. He had the connections. Who was one of the world's greatest cricketers. You think of all sorts of people who could have done all kinds of things in life, who said, no, that's not enough. I need to do more. There's a story told of a missionary working in an African country who was approached by Standard Oil to become their representative in that country. And he was offered a fabulous salary because he knew the country as no other Westerner did. He had a trust, he had a confidence, he had a knowledge of the local culture, and they said, we'll pay you megabucks to give up being a missionary and start working for Standard Oil. And his answer to them simply was, I'm afraid you're not giving me enough. I have a job that's far bigger. God has called me to be a missionary. Why should I dwindle into being an executive when I can do what God has called me to? So, sophistication, but it was also a spiritual kind of a place. This is one of the few buildings that we've got left on the site of Ur nowadays, and it's a ziggurat. It must have looked like the little insect picture when it was first built. We've lost the top of it, but it's a kind of step pyramid that was used to worship the moon god and the other gods that were around in Ur in those days. And even as you look at it now, it's a pretty impressive building, and you can imagine what it was like with thousands of worshippers crowding into it for ceremonies. This is one artist's impression of what it would have looked like when people came from all the region round about to Ur for one of the great religious ceremonies. And Abram grew up in a very religious culture. There were temples all over Ur. And each temple had its own kitchen, had its own dining room for the god to eat in. And the gods were part of daily life in a very direct and relevant kind of a way. But it wasn't enough. And Abram wasn't content with being sophisticated and being spiritual. He wanted something more. He wanted to know the truth of the real living God. He wasn't content to stay just where he was. And that's the third thing. Abraham was settled. Because Mesopotamian life was pretty predictable. The reason they were able to make all of these discoveries was because they had a pretty settled society. It wasn't a case of wars and empires and people scheming and plotting and having conspiracies all over the place. Because they believed that these gods in Mesopotamia had brought order out of chaos. That's what had happened at the start of the world. The gods had battled the forces of chaos and they'd brought order. But having done that, they didn't want to sustain the whole of creation by themselves. So then they made human beings. And human beings were told, right, this is your job, mate. You are going to be our slaves. You are going to be our workforce. You keep the earth going for us, and we will ensure that chaos does not return. And so there's a deal between the gods and men. And human beings exist to be the slaves of the gods, living in a predictable way. Mind you, the Californian historian Brendan Nagel says this, despite the gods' apparent victory over chaos, there was no guarantee that the forces of chaos might not recover their strength and overturn the orderly creation of the gods. Gods and humans alike were involved in the perpetual struggle to restrain the powers of chaos, and they each had their own role to play in this dramatic battle. The responsibility of the dwellers of Mesopotamian cities was to provide the gods with everything they needed to run the world. So as long as you kept on living in this harmonious, routine, predictable, settled pattern, chaos would not return. And Abram wasn't prepared to live in that settled kind of way. I wonder if I'm speaking to anybody this morning whose Christian life has just settled down a bit. And you're living in a settled kind of a way that's got no more adventure left to it. You've got a little bit of spirituality. And you're living in a fairly sophisticated way. And you're not ready for a God who says, look, I'm doing a new thing and I want you to be part of it. I want to pitchfork you out into more adventures of faith. I want to take you on a step further. I want to stretch you. Well, that's what happened to Abraham. And if you want to be blessed to be a blessing, that might be the first challenge you have to face. Naghmeh Abedini, who's the wife of Syed Abedini, the guy who's well known at the moment for being in prison in Iran, quite unjustly. She's been campaigning for his freedom. And she says, you know, we try to pretend sometimes our families are perfect. And she shocked everybody just before Christmas by admitting that her husband was not perfect. Although he's in jail for his faith and he's suffering heroically as a Christian, nonetheless, they have a rocky marriage in some ways. And it's partly because of his attitude to women, which she thinks is far from perfect. But she says this, how much do we boast that our lives and families are not as perfect as they appear? We have to remember that Jesus shines through our weakness. The world will know who Jesus is through our weakness and his strength that shines through our weakness and brokenness. We don't do it by pretending to be perfect. We have to be careful not to fall into the false reality that the world is creating with no wrinkles and stains. We also have to be careful not to be like the religious leaders who present their outward appearances flawless, but inside they've lost their connection with God. We have to remember that Christianity was not made to be a religion, but to be an intimate relationship with our Maker. It's not about being religious. It's about knowing God and having adventures with him. And that takes us on to the second thing. Dare to be dependent. Because Abram wasn't just going out there to do the best he could. He was going out there pinning his faith absolutely and desperately to the idea that God would keep his promises. This is what the Apostle Paul says in Romans chapter 4 in the New Testament about the whole thing. We call Abraham father, not because he got God's attention by living like a saint, but because God made something out of Abraham when he was a nobody. Abraham didn't focus on his own impotence and say, this is hopeless, this 100-year-old body could never father a child. Nor did he survey Sarah's decades of infertility and give up. He didn't tiptoe around God's promise, asking cautiously skeptical questions. He plunged into the promise and came up strong, ready for God, sure that God would make good on what he had said. That's why it said Abraham was declared fit before God by trusting God to set him right. But it's not just Abraham, says the Apostle Paul. It's also us. That's a challenge we face as well. And if you want a bit more about this, do come tonight and listen to Jeremy, a guy who's been slapped in the face by life several times. The death of his son would be crushing enough, but his own imminent death at a comparatively young age. How do you handle that? How do you go on believing that God has a plan, that God is working through it? How can you hear the voice of God? How can you hold his hand more firmly when you're in a situation like that? Dare to be dependent. And as you follow Abram's journey, you see that he was on a search for the reality of a God he could trust in, because every place he went to was a religious center. They stopped in Haran for a long time, and Haran was the pilgrimage center of the moon god. It's where the moon god center was worshipped. As he went down the coast, he'd have gone through Nerab, the holy city of the moon god cult. Perhaps he was losing his faith in the moon god by this point, because the Bible doesn't say anything about him stopping in Nerab, but he must certainly have passed through it. He came to Shechem. We read about that in the passage. The site of the cult of the Canaanite god Baal-Berit, the Lord of the Covenant. And maybe Abram's focusing in now and saying, this God that I'm trying to find out about, he's one who makes promises, one who makes agreements. The Lord of the Covenant sounds like the kind of guy he would be. Then he moves on to Bethel, 30 miles south. And that was the holy city centered on El, the one God of the Canaanites, the supreme God. And Abram's thinking, I'm looking for the supreme God. I'm looking for the one who's in charge of the whole show. And after Bethel, he goes on to Mamre. That's outside our passage. And there, again, there's a shrine of El. And that's where God comes to him and says, Abram, I'm still here. I'm still keeping my promises. And Sarah is going to have a son. And so gradually you see Abram focusing in more and more on who is this God I'm tangling with, and learning more and more lessons about him. And as a result, the Bible tells us, not once but three times, Abraham's title is the friend of God. You read it first, a few hundred years later, when an Israelite king, maybe 1,200 years after Abraham, is praying and he says, did you not give this land forever, God, to the descendants of your friend Abraham? Clearly, that's how Abraham was thought of after his death. The prophet Isaiah, 800 years after that, repeats it. Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the offspring of Abraham, my friend. And so the legend goes on down through the years, the tradition that Abraham was God's friend in a very special way, until you reach the New Testament. And in the book of James, Abraham was called the friend of God. How much do you want to be a friend of God? How much do you thirst to know more of the living God, to walk with him through life, to take whatever adventure he throws to you, to say, blessed be your name, though I'm found in the desert place. You give and take away, blessed be your name. Whether it's good or it's bad, I'm going through it with you. And you find Abram gradually developing in his understanding of God. Through those chapters in Exodus, you get different names that Abram gives to God as he gradually finds out who God is. And you see the passages where it's these names come up. They're all part of the Abram story, Genesis 14, 15, 16, 17, 21, 22. And all of these different meanings of names fill in more and more for Abram who this God is that's being spoken about. El Elyon, the highest God, the supreme God over every other God that might exist. Adonai, the Lord, the boss who runs the whole show. El Roi, he who sees. It wasn't Abram that came up with that one. It was Hagar, his maidservant, who was cast out to die in the wilderness. And she said, there's a God here who sees me, who understands me through and through. He's not just the all-high God, but he knows everything about my life, every detail. And so Abram then discovers God is El Shaddai, the all-sufficient one. El Olam, the everlasting one. Yehovah Yireh, the provider of everything that he needs. And bit by bit, his picture of God is filling out and coming into focus. And these are challenges to his faith. How will this barren woman ever have a baby? When she has the baby by an incredible miracle, why does God say, I want you to offer him as a sacrifice? And those massive, massive challenges to God's faith challenge Abram again and again. How prepared are you to be dependent on me? Here's Nagbe Abedini again, talking about what it's like to be a Christian. It can mean letting go of everything you have been taught and have believed to be true. It might mean losing your community, friends, and your family. When I became a follower of Jesus at the age of 9, I had to let go of all I'd been taught as a Muslim, despite the cost and the rejection and the persecution that came from my own family. And she says, in the same way, if you want to follow Jesus, then you will have to let go of all you've been taught and have believed and be willing to accept Jesus as your Lord and Savior and accept the Bible as God's living word and the final authority in your life, despite the cost. Dare to be dependent. And the final thing to finish with, dare to be determined. Because the great thing about Abram, as you read at the end of the chapter, in the last verse there, is Abram kept moving, steadily making his way south towards the Negev. And when you see him at the end of our passage, he's still moving forward. He's still going. He was going to get it wrong on many occasions. He was going to have situations where his faith almost failed him for fear. But he was going to keep on going, whatever happened. This is Dietz Emmin, a Dutch lady who now lives in Michigan in America. She's 96. She hasn't always looked like that. In 1939, when the Second World War broke out, she looked like this. She was born in 1920, so that made her about 19. And she had a boyfriend whom she hadn't been too interested in to start with, but he grew on her, and his name was Hein Sietsma. And the two of them, when the Germans came into Holland, decided that God was calling them to shelter Jewish people, to help them escape the convoys that would take them off to the concentration camps. And they started an organization with a few friends called Hein, H-E-I-N, after his name, and helped Elkander in Nood. That's a terrible pronunciation, Marion, but it's the best I can do. Help one another in need. And they believed that because God had blessed them, they had to be a blessing to others. And so they took Jews and sheltered them. They stole ration cards and fake documents so that people would have enough food to live on while they were being hidden. They did everything they could to keep the Jews out of trouble. And as a result, both of them ended up in concentration camps. She survived, Hein did not. And as he was taken on the train towards Dachau, where he lost his life, he went into the toilet on the train, got a piece of toilet paper, and wrote on it very carefully a letter to her. He then wrapped it round a stone and threw it out of the window with her address on it. Amazingly, 3 months later, it was delivered to her. And this is part of what he said in that letter. This is the original here, which she still keeps in her purse. Darling, don't count on our seeing each other again soon. Here we see again that we do not decide our own lives. Even if we don't see each other again on earth, we'll never be sorry for what we did, that we took this stand. And I know, Diet, that out of every last human being in this world, I loved you most. Two people who were prepared to give everything they had because God had blessed them to be a blessing. And so if you want to be like Abram, if you want to be like them, then you've got to be prepared to keep on going. And I wonder if any of us are running out of steam, running out of energy, finding at the start of yet another year, we just don't have the vision, we just don't have the commitment to go anywhere with God, to try a new adventure. Let's ask him to give us that encouragement, that motivation to keep moving forward, like Abram's great namesake, Abraham Lincoln, who said, I walk slowly, but I never walk backward. Let's keep moving forward. Go to Zermatt in Switzerland and you'll see this place. This is a mountaineer's graveyard. And in that graveyard you'll find all sorts of stones that are testimony to the fact that people have lost their lives on the Matterhorn and the other mountains around Zermatt. This is the Breithorn, one of the most treacherous mountains around. And there's a tombstone in that cemetery to a young man who was only 17, came from New York City, who died on the Breithorn. And he died in 1975, and at first they weren't sure what to put on his tombstone. And then they put this, Donald Stephen Williams, New York City. And it ends, I chose climbing. I wasn't going to stay at home by the fire. I wasn't going to settle down and do nothing. I was going to get out there and do something. Okay, it cost me my life, but I was following my vision. I was following my dream. I was doing what I was called to do. I chose climbing. And any of us could be run over by a bus at any point today. That's if you step out in the middle of the road, of course. If that happened to you, would that be the phrase you could put on your tombstone? I died climbing. I chose to climb. Keep on going. Dare to be different. And so in Hebrews chapter 11 in the New Testament, looking back on the story of Abraham and Sarah, mentioning also Isaac, their son, and Jacob, his son, the writer of Hebrews says this, each one of these people of faith died not yet having in hand what was promised, but still believing. How did they do it? They saw it way off in the distance, waved their greeting and accepted the fact that they were transients in this world. And then the writer to Hebrews says, people who live this way make it plain that they are looking for their true home. You looking for your true home? We're going to sing our last song in a moment. Dare to be different. Dare to be dependent. Dare to be determined. That's a challenge that Abraham throws to you. And the challenge I think God wants us to take seriously at the start of 2016.